My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Kunduff.
What do you have for us today?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And you can go visit them up on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake. And they've got everything you need in the way of John Deere products. Go up and see them. If they don't have it, they can get it for you. And they've also got steel and Honda power products. So fully stocked up there. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And free commercial of the week goes to Sleep Number.
Sleep Number.
Sleep Number. I love them. Okay, this is how great they are. Even when you refer somebody to the Sleep Number. I like it. I like it, but it makes me laugh. The slumber song. Yeah, when you refer somebody to their store, you get actual money credit for that, whether you know you did it or not. And if it's going to expire, like mine is, we've got $50.
Wait for it. Novel concept.
Yeah, we have 50 clams in the hopper that are going to expire in September. And John from Sleep Number here in Reading called me yesterday or the day before to say that he wanted to make sure that I got my $50. Don't let it expire. And I thought, how great are you guys? Nobody calls to tell you that your free money is going to expire. They just sit there and hold their breath and hope they get their free money back.
Yeah.
Not the Sleep Number
people.
Goes in
the beer fund.
Yeah. Pizza money.
Pizza money.
Yeah, so anyway, they're pretty great. Yeah, once you go do the little try out the bed, yeah, you have to take one home because they're so awesome. So anyway, we have Jackie on the phone. Do we have Jackie on the phone?
Hello?
Nodding her head? He's nodding his head. We do.
Oh, there she is. Hello, Jackie.
I was trying to read it the top of his head. All I could see was the top of his head. I was reading his mind through the top of his head. I wanted to know if we had Jackie on there because I was going to say she is the founder of Whistleblowers of America. I've emailed with Jackie, but we've never spoken, so I didn't mess up the show by learning all about it beforehand. which is just the worst. It's like you just don't ask the right questions. You already know all the stuff. It's terrible. So she is a policy and program expert with 30 years of service to the military and the veteran community. She was a political appointee at the Pentagon for 8 years, setting up personnel programs for wounded warriors and the Defense Suicide Prevention Office. I didn't know there was such an office, actually. She established a crisis hotline in Afghanistan and later investigated issues related to diversity and inclusion and No Fear Act violations. While working for the Defense Department, she blew the whistle on fraud, waste, and abuse. I bet that didn't go well. And suffered retaliation. There we go. The usual outcome. Before that, she worked for the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, Disability Assistance, and Memorial Affairs subcommittees, drafting legislation to assist disabled veterans and their families. She's a former Army social work officer, and she's used her clinical knowledge to inform her advocacy and intervention work with the American Legion as the Deputy Director for Healthcare, and then with the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission. It just goes on and on and on. She has started Whistleblowers of America, but you know, Jackie, I didn't look. When was that anyway? How long have you guys been Whistleblowers? Uh-oh. Are you in there? Sounds really quiet, and there was a clicking noise. Clicking and then silence is bad.
It looks like we lost her. I'll give her a call back and see if we can get her back. It dropped on her end. So.
Okay. Yeah, clicking and silence usually portends bad things. Oh, there she is. She's calling us. God bless her. So let's see. You can find their site at whistleblowersofamerica.org. So that's easy. Hey, Jackie.
Hey, how are you?
Through the magic of technology, we lost you right as we said hi, Jackie, and then you were gone. So,
well, hopefully we are synced up now.
Good to go. Well, tell me this. When did you start this organization?
So we started Whistleblowers of America in 2017. We're coming up on our fifth anniversary, which I'm very excited about, and I'm hoping we're going to get to celebrate actually on July 25th in D.C. But we started this really, after all my experiences with combat vets and suicide and PTSD, I began to see a lot of the similarities between combat vets and those that were surviving this hostile work environment. And it was when I was talking to a woman I met randomly on social media, and she confessed that she had a gun and she was thinking about killing herself. And I decided we have to do this. And I called an attorney, and here we are 5 years later.
Yeah, because, you know, I always tell people, I'm like, when you speak to a member of Congress or their staff, the communications are all protected. There's no way the agencies can compel them to say who they're speaking with. So if it doesn't require them to turn over documents and all that, they can tell the member or their staff what to ask for and kind of guide them into how to blow up the issue that way.
Right.
But that doesn't work for everything.
Right. So here's the problem we're running into with that. So we've discovered that when members of Congress, when they, their offices communicate with organizations like the VA, that communication goes into what VA calls views, and I forget what views stands for, but it's like a Salesforce share communication portal that over almost 2,500 people at the VA, so managers, supervisors at every medical center, regional office, has eyes on this, and we have actually found where letters from a member of Congress where the whistleblower said, please keep this confidential and my name anonymous, that letter went into the packet from the Congress to the VA, and that whistleblower's name is there for everybody to see, along with all your PII, your PHI.
But you have to define that, because we have people listening from all over that don't know what any of that means.
So your PII is your personally identified information, so like your name, address, date of birth, social security number. Your PHI is your medical records. So anybody who has submitted anything like that to Congress and then Congress turns around and says, hey, we want the VA to investigate this, there's no, or there should be no presumption that that will be confidential. So we're always really mindful to tell people, be really careful what you negotiate and make sure your congressional staffer that you're talking to understands those limitations and confidentiality. They really have to do the extra legwork and de-identify that PII information if they're sending it to the VA or probably any other government organization. I can't imagine the VA is unique in this, but you really are not communicating confidentially when you send your information to congressional staff, and then
no,
congressional
but if you,
staff opens an inquiry.
Yeah, if my suggestion was not to put it in writing, actually. My recommendation was don't put it in writing. Yeah, call and, hey, you should ask for, you know, this, 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 and this, and then they can ask for it and then check back with the person and find out if they got the truth or not. If they didn't, then they can re-ask.
Right.
That works in a lot of instances and doesn't put anybody in the crosshairs, because honestly, everybody I've ever talked to who was a legitimate whistleblower, we're not talking about, you know, tattling about broken cookies in the lunchroom. I mean, actual real stuff. The fact that they were they had bonuses set up for denying claims and different things like that. I'm thinking of Rusty Ann Brown with the VA in Oakland.
Oh yeah,
and we had her. We talked about her case quite a bit on here, and yeah, I mean, there were 14,000 claims that had been buried for 20 years, and she comes forward and says something about it, and they just ground her into the dirt.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with
her. I know
that
you know
case
her case
as well, and many, many others. I mean, in our 5 years, we're closing in on 900 whistleblower conversations, and I'd say easily 40% of my workload similar to what the Office of Special Counsel would say is their workload, comes from the Department of Veterans Affairs. So we know that across the board, that's where a lot of the whistleblowers are. And that makes sense because the VA is one of the largest departments in the federal government. It has the most employees, and they're doing some very high-touch stuff. I mean, they're actually providing benefits and services to people. So it would make sense that the people who have eyes on the wrongdoing are providing services to veterans. And our veterans often themselves.
Yeah, that's the hardest part, is a lot of them went from active military service to work at the VA to help, you know, people who were returning. And
which should be a good thing.
Yeah, but they unfortunately wind up in a system that doesn't necessarily have that as the best interest, I guess. So,
I was going to say that one of the other things we find is we also get a lot of military whistleblowers, and they're unaware that if they've been retaliated against, if there's bullying, hazing, you know, harassment, not just sexual harassment, but these other kinds of attacks on your character, your integrity, if you're marginalized, shunned, ostracized, the same kinds of things we see in the employment sector, that if you're transitioning from being on active duty to the VA in the private sector, you can be service-connected for PTSD, for what they call personal trauma. It's a very similar type of trauma as combat stress, except that it is more about your person and your identity than it is about the war and the death and destruction that you witnessed.
Yeah, because these guys, you know, in a lot of cases, they will go to any length to keep you from messing up their, you know, their little schemes that they've got going on. And there are schemes. We've done lots of shows with Kristen Rule, she was the one who connected us to you, obviously. And, you know, we used to go through all the stuff with Rubens and Graves and the crazy stuff they did and the you know, text messages they sent. And, just absolutely nutty group of people.
And what I find still remarkable is that the some of the same people that were in the leadership chain when all that went down, who resigned, are now on an $80 million contract for the GI Bill, which was awarded with CARES funding. So one type of funding is now funding this CARES GI Bill for IT, and these were the same people that were previously suspended or under investigation. I mean, we don't know all the details per se, but we know that it's some of the same people that are now on contracts that are receiving millions and millions of dollars in government money who were at one point the very same people who the government sanctioned for doing the wrong thing in these cases. But now they've been rewarded with these contracts.
How do you account for that? Is there just no oversight on the, it's just, you hear about this constantly in government where people are either accused or convicted basically of wrongdoing, and yet they move up the food chain and they pop back up.
Well, and I think that's the key, is this accountability. It's the ability to close the loop. So if you've ever been sanctioned, investigated, you know, there should be some transparency to that. So that if you are a contractor and you're coming back to the government now and asking for money on a contract, there should at least be some visibility to the current senior leaders that this person has previously been suspended, resigned, you know, demoted, reassigned, you know, detailed, you know, whatever it is
right.
that was related to the wrongdoing should be transparent.
Well, I know in private industry, which we all know is much, much different than government.
Oh, no, it's just like government, only just slightly different.
Well, when you fill out an application, I mean, there's questions like, have you ever worked for this company before? Have any of your relatives worked for this company before? Mm-hmm. Were you ever discharged from this company? I mean, do they go through any kind of a process like that when they get? Of course, they're private contractors, so I guess.
One case I can think of here locally, we had a gal working in the psych department. I think she was the director, actually, for the clinic here. She regularly told her employees that PTSD was something veterans fake in order to get free money. And the employees were, I mean, needless to say, upset about that. And she eventually was exited, only to pop up at QTC, which the first word is quality, which just freaks me out. But QTC does all the independent exams for the VA. And it was like, hey, wait a second. It's kind of great, though. A smart attorney in Sacramento who does a lot of VA cases helped the local folks here file against her medical license. And, I don't think that's going to turn out very, very well. But still, she was able to actually have more power over them than she ever had.
Yeah, moved right back on up.
At the clinic level, so I don't think they check at all. Mm-hmm. Jackie, we have to take quick break. We'll be right back. We can let everybody go get some decaf because this is probably not a good show for
blood pressure.
For full-on coffee. We'll be right back. Our guest is Jackie Garrick. We are talking about whistleblowers, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
All gave some, and some gave all, and some stood through for the red, white, and blue, and some had to fall. And if you ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall.
All right, Jackie. So when people find you, are they from just the VA, or do you guys do all agencies, all topics?
So we do all kinds of topics, not even just federal government.
Oh.
We just opened up as a peer support network, and I've tried really hard not to turn anybody away. So we even get people from, like, the United Kingdom call in, Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. I've been on the radio in New Zealand talking about whistleblower retaliation.
Wow. So we're not the only
everywhere.
We're not the only ones that don't want people to give up the inside scoop, huh?
Yeah. So the piece that I'm most concerned about is I see the retaliation as harmful, like other kinds of trauma. So I don't adjudicate the cases. We help people problem solve, make decisions, but we don't decide for them. You know, I'll try to help people figure out what evidence is and what they need to do and are they ready for whistleblowing. But then we also help them understand, like, well, you're being gaslit. That's why you feel so crazy. You're being ostracized. That's why you need to connect with other people who understand this kinds of case. You're being marginalized, shunned. blacklisted or blocked, as we prefer to call it these days. You're being counter-accused. So we help them understand the things that are happening to them. And I see that as universal, just like other forms of trauma are universal. You know, we talk about combat veterans and their trauma. It doesn't matter the uniform you're wearing. It doesn't matter the perpetrator. Trauma is trauma.
Yeah. I could see that. The thing about it that's interesting is, well, it's funny because Bill had that even in the equipment business. When
equipment trauma?
Yeah, no, I'll give you some trauma. Okay. We're going to have some trauma on the break. When you first went there, and he's like, hey, wait a minute. You can't do like this and this. And you guys got to do like this and this and this. And they were like playing with remote control cars, driving around the showroom because there was nobody there to like tell them not to. And so he's like, this is an actual business. We need to be at work, you know. And what they tell you, like, you were messing up the...
Yeah, we got a good thing here. Let's don't make any waves.
That's right. Bill's the problem.
Wow.
So I don't think any facet is immune, but I do think that one big myth, especially in government services, well, you declare yourself a whistleblower, and it's like you have a cloak of invisibility, and no one can touch you. And I'm like, not really.
It's funny. I've never heard of a whistleblower that didn't end up being retaliated against, and they're not supposed to be.
Right.
Right.
There's like a million. There's a million laws. I know they send the congressional offices like workbook after workbook, how to work with whistleblowers, and it's like, because you're so concerned about their well-being.
Yeah. Make sure you get their name, address, and phone number.
And make sure you put it in the views system.
Views.
Can you imagine that? All the confidential stuff is in there, so everyone can look. Oh, hey, so-and-so's a whistleblower. Hey, look what they said about you.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I always say if there isn't retaliation, it's not really whistleblowing. It's continuous process improvement.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
Well, and then you take it to the inspector general, and, you know, the inspector general is supposed to, you know, get out there and whoop them up. And I know back when we were doing so many shows with the VA whistleblowers, what the heck? You have almost 400,000 employees at the VA, and you have 970 people at the inspector general's office for VA. So it's like, you know, pretty sure they're going to get away with a lot. And once they write their report, it goes to the VA first. Their raw data is never made public to the congressional offices that did the inquiry.
No, I'm familiar with how that goes.
But I don't think the public knows that. I think they think, well, you call the inspector general, and then they come in, and then you know, everybody gets to find out what's going on. It's like, well, no, that isn't how that works.
And the OIG has no teeth. I mean, they just make a recommendation.
Yeah, and they need more money and more training. That is the recommendation in every report.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More money, more training. Yeah. Oh, okay, gosh, we could have figured that out all by ourselves.
Right. And I think because they know their recommendations don't have the teeth that we would like to see them have, they don't make the more serious recommendations. I mean, when was the last time the VA OIG recommended prosecution of an actual crime? That is rare.
Never happened. Did they ever do it?
But it's rare. Yeah, I mean, that's like, I've been chatting with Bruce Sackman, the special agent who wrote the book Behind the Murder Curtain about medical serial killers that operated at the VA. But it took a, you know, full court press kind of operation where you have to get the FBI involved, district attorneys. I mean, that's why when I talk to VA police officers, even their hands are tied by the VA medical center directors. They can't just take a case to the Department of Justice. If the medical center director says, don't arrest that guy or don't investigate, you know, that theft, and don't worry about drug diversion, we got this, well, then their hands are tied, and those cases, those criminal cases, don't even go forward, much less these OIG audits.
Yeah, that's crazy. What
that is
in your experience, what is the most reported of whistleblower complaints? Is there one area in particular that comes up more often?
So at VA, It mostly relates to patient care, standards of care, substandard care, numbers of clinicians available to see patients, how they fictionalize reports and numbers. So like I've had whistleblowers tell me that they will not say somebody is severely suicidal. They'll just say mild or moderate so as not to have to activate a more expensive protocol.
Oh.
Or they'll say somebody is transitioning from homelessness, that they've gone from one place to the other. They're in transition when, in fact, they are really homeless.
Hmm. And this is all just to avoid expenses and payouts, is that right?
Yeah, so, I mean, think about all these medical center directors, chiefs of staff, chiefs of surgery. I mean, these folks who their performance metrics are dependent upon looking good as an organization. So if my bonus and my performance appraisal is all about my making sure there are no problems, nothing looks bad, our numbers are all good, then it is understandable why then that they would really push people to not report the bad stuff. So because what gets measured gets done, right? Isn't that the old adage? So if you don't measure it, you don't have to do it. And if you don't have to do it, then you can save money. You're not going to come in over budget. I mean, think about the ripple effect and the implications for all these things.
Right.
That's why we've worked with Ted Blicklettle, who has written the book Broken Promises about the VA and the Vet Center program. I mean, when I first talked to Ted, now this goes back a couple of years, he was upset about the requirements for vet center counselors to see patients. And when we looked at it, it was around 30 patients. And then when I pulled some of the reports and their numbers, the number of counselors they said they had and the number of patients they said they saw, and I did some of my own basic rudimentary math, I was coming up with, well, that's more like 33 patients a clinician. The National Association of Social Workers recommends that social workers carry a caseload of about 25 patient contacts a week. So the VA was well over that. And so he has really gone to the mats on this. I mean, he resigned from the VA. He's gone to Congress. He's wrote legislative language, which I now think is going to become part of the NDAA, that requires caps on how many patients a clinician can be required to see, because the burnout, the stress, the, you know, what that does to quality care, all of that is impacted when you don't have these controls over the demands that the hierarchy will place on the boots on the ground clinicians.
Yeah, it just turns into a little factory. Everybody comes in. Oh, look at the time. Yeah, which is so helpful for people.
It kind of reminds me of our school system. You know, you cram as many as you can in the room and then shoot them all out the other end. And, okay, they're fixed. Next.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't look at how many can read. So, Jackie, you guys, I'm kind of hoping, actually, that people call you and say, you know, I've discovered this whole thing that agency or company or whatever is doing, and I'm thinking about blowing the whistle on them. Do they call you before they've done it, or do they wait until after everybody's, you know, putting cyanide in their lunchbox?
Yeah, various and sundry times that we'll hear from people. I mean, of course, we want to hear from people before they've blown the whistle, and we can coach them into the process and, you know, help them figure out, do you have the right evidence? Do you have an attorney? Do you need an attorney right now? are you really ready for this? Have you talked to your family? Do you know this is going to be 5 to 10 years of your life?
Mm-hmm.
Are you really ready for this?
Yeah, and are you ready for the idea that it might not actually, no matter how noble the motives, no matter how great the evidence, that it may wind up on the dust in the dustbin of history?
Right, right. But on the other side of this, if most people don't wake up one morning and think, oh, I think I'm going to be a whistleblower today.
Yeah, no.
You know, they're struggling with something. You know, they maybe have raised the caution flag and said, oh, this doesn't seem right, or I don't understand what this is about, or can you double-check this? And they're kind of making their story known or their issue known. They're not thinking, oh, I need to go to the OIG. They're raising it with their boss or a coworker. I mean, that's what I did. I went right to the person originally and said, hey, you should be recusing yourself. This is not a good idea for you to be talking about the company where you had been a vice president, where her husband was a sub to the prime. I thought that was a conflict of interest. And I told her. And then when I started feeling like, why is she being mean to me, right? I was getting these emails and they were questioning what I was doing and other people were all of a sudden being copied.
Yeah, you know, rotten egg, you. How dare you point out our bad choices?
Yeah, that becomes the intimidation that goes with this.
And I'm guessing we haven't even begun to touch what happens with the coworkers because they... Yeah, I would imagine you've got a couple of camps. I mean, you got the one camp where they've known about it or are complicit in it, so they definitely don't want it coming out. They'll get in trouble. Then you have the other people who, just because of their personality style, they just want everybody to get along, and they realize this is going to turn into World War III. So you have as a whistleblower, they wind up with a lot of internal pressure because now they're the rat fink.
Right. Yeah, and it's how do you find your allies and get your witnesses documented? Have your what you need for your discovery, your interrogatories, your admissions. Like, how do you organize all of that even before you blow the whistle? The first time somebody called me a whistleblower, I was shocked. I was, what? No, that's not what I'm doing. That's not what happened. And then she said, no, that's a prohibited personnel practice. And it took somebody in HR to explain it to me. And was the first person who explained to me what my rights were and what I could do about it. I was shocked and appalled. And, you know, you think about the things that go well in a case and the things that go badly. For me, I thought once I gave the case to the Office of Special Counsel, OSC, they were going to do everything for me. I had no idea that I needed to do all the footwork. And the person I made my initial disclosure to, he passed away before they interviewed him.
Ugh.
So I had to, and thank goodness I had other witnesses to the situation who were able to kind of fill in the blanks. But it would have been nice to have had the guy who I made the disclosure to on the record in his own words. And that hurt my case in some ways. Now, it took a long time. It took me about 5 years. I eventually, the agency originally said they would settle with me, sent me to OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, and then they sort of reneged on what they said they would do when we got to OPM, so I ended up having to go to MSPB. But when I read to the MSPB judge these emails that I did not get on discovery but got on a FOIA, when I was able to read things to him, and in their own words, some of the things that were said about me behind my back, thinking I would never see them, the judge was in agreement. He agreed that this was retaliation, there was animus, and this was a hostile work environment. And I was able to settle with a disability retirement.
Hmm.
And I got my back pay and my retirement, and I took that money and we built Whistleblowers of America. We kind of reinvested back into what we're doing so that we can help more people. So I do want more people to reach out to us and get more involved and have that kind of peer-to-peer conversation, just because it helps you think it out.
Well,
you
and it's helpful because a lot of times people who set up things like this, they care about it, but maybe didn't have any firsthand experience in the fact that you've actually been there and done that, as they say. That helps a whole lot. We have to take one more quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, Jackie Garrick, from Whistleblowers of America. You can find her at, let's see here, make sure I get it right, whistleblowersofamerica.org. Didn't want to get the dot incorrect. And we've got that all listed on our site for today. Today, actually, I should point that out, is July 17th in case we re-air this. And you can find it on the July 17th show at wethepeopleradio.us. Just in case you turn your website into a musical, you can use that one.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so Bill's got
Jackie,
a burning question.
I had a question. How many people that come to you actually have a cause versus how many are just unhappy employees and need to just go back to work?
Well, like I said, the big good part about what we do is that we don't make judgments on that, right? I'm not adjudicating their case. I'm trying to help them solve problems and make decisions. So my understanding is that, you know, 9 times out of 10, there's been something that has happened in the workplace that is upsetting, distressing, and we're going to try to figure out what that is.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, somebody will come to me and I'll say, well, what evidence do you have? How do you know that? Can you prove it? And we'll talk through it. I have sometimes said to somebody, you're not ready yet for this.
Yeah, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that aren't ready. I mean, they don't realize what it's going to really take to make a case.
And or they have a lot of suspicion. They've got a lot of smoke but no fire.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's no there. Sometimes it is. They just have to know how to prepare themselves for it.
Okay.
And I think that's the goal that I have, is to really hear what they've got going on and how do you parse it out. And sometimes it's, well, you know, send this part of your complaint to the OIG, let them investigate the wrongdoing, but go to the EEO, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and talk about your, you know, is it racism, sexism, disability? I find that one's a huge misunderstanding on both sides. People don't understand things like the American with Disabilities Act, the what's a reasonable accommodation, what's FMLA leave, you know, what are you entitled to, what are you not entitled to? All of those things need to be sorted out. And sometimes it's a matter of just helping the person with their perspective. I mean, I remember talking to one woman once who worked, I believe, for the Navy as a civilian, and she was really struggling. She was like one of the only women in the office, felt very left out, put upon, didn't get the same opportunities as the men. She was filing complaint after complaint. And I said, well, what's filing the complaints getting you? And she said, nothing. And I said, well, let's change the strategy.
Yeah, no kidding.
And we talked about her strategy for how she deals with her coworkers. And, you know, it ended up where we thought, okay, well, here's the plan. Here's how you can own your narrative, take control of the situation, you know, re-energize the bullies in another way, and then do what's best for you in your career. And I never heard from her again. I don't know if I'm going to assume it worked or she quit. She didn't want to quit. She liked her job. But it really was just a matter of maybe having that conversation about how are you managing your own resilience. So it can be anything.
This is also a great, you know, if you have a friend or a family member who's having all these problems and they think that they've got, you know, some kind of corruption or different things going on that are improper, calling you guys is a great first step. You know, because most of the time, especially if it's in a line of work that you're, you know, that you don't know anything about it, you can't help them. So you guys are you've got a really wide cast of characters. How about that in your board of directors? I was looking at that. You have a former director of forensic investigations in the U.S. Government Accountability Office. You have the host of the Whistleblower Revolution. That's kind of fun. I should listen to that.
Heidi is great.
You have the founder of the Whistleblower Law Firm. Mm-hmm. You have a retired Navy Judge Advocate General. You have a clinical social worker. I don't know what Whisply is, but he is founder and CEO of that. What is a Whisply?
So Whisply is an anonymous way. You can go to your company and report wrongdoing.
That's helpful.
So Sylvain Monfont was a whistleblower. He was a Frenchman working for a non-French company. So he thought, well, if I call their hotline and whistleblow, they're going to know it's me. I'm the only one with a French accent.
We will keep your information secret.
So he created Whisply. He won his case as well. I think it was like a $25 million settlement.
That's a lot of Whisply.
That he found in a construction company. And then what he's created with Whisply is a tool that allows you to sort of become an avatar, an icon, that they only know you as, you know, the pink elephant, as opposed to Sylvain Monfont by name. They only know that pink elephant has made a disclosure about, you know, accounting fraud or standards of care issues. You know, we get, you know, like a lot of nurses will report Medicare or Medicaid fraud. The cherry picking and lemon dropping, as they call it. So this is a way a private company who really does want to hear from their whistleblowers can buy into a system. And there are other ones like it. I think it's getting to be more common in use to have systems by which your employees can tell you things anonymously.
Well, unlike the VA, where they tell you that it's anonymous, but then it turns out they have a whole different email system where they all share the information. How crazy is that? It appears, I haven't gone through each of them, but it appears that almost everybody has had some close contact, if not being a whistleblower. Paul Pearson, your vice president, and his background is in cybersecurity. How helpful is that?
Yeah, very.
Because a lot of what happens in the whistleblowing involves technology. A lot of the data that proves the problem is manipulated in their systems, and that's why that's why they're not getting in trouble, because they're reporting fiction. Can he help them with that?
Yeah, I mean, so that's why it's so important for us to have this network, and why we're trying to grow the network as well, is it really helps to have, like, my stuff is Defense Department, but government more broadly in that process. But, like, when I get, like, a national security whistleblower or somebody where it involves IT and data or banking, you know, the Security Exchange Commission, the Commodities and Futures Trade Commission, I can never remember the FCTF, those folks are going through a different process. Some are going into the courts. You know, we've had people whose cases have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. So it's helpful to have a network where we can connect people to people who have had similar circumstances. Like my VA police officers are all police officers. You know, they understand the rules and the dynamics by which they're operating under and what's unique to their profession. So I think that's why the peer support model works.
I think that's awesome. There's also a donate button on the front, so if you have, you know, if we have people listening that are thinking, you know, I did that, nobody helped me because there was nobody around, this would be a worthy cause to support.
So
that there are not other people like you that get left hanging.
Right.
What's one thing that people just fundamentally misunderstand about the whole whistleblower thing, whether they're the whistleblower or they're just a private citizen?
So I think it's the trauma. It's the, first of all, knowing that there's wrongdoing. Like, I can't imagine the psychiatrist that first reported medical serial killers at her medical center. That trauma of, if you're not successful, then it lives with you, right? You were trying to stop the wrongdoing. You were trying to stop water from being contaminated, from children from being abused. I was trying to reduce suicide rates. When you can't do those things and the retaliation interferes, that sense of survivor guilt, moral injury that we talk so much about. And then the retaliation is really the spill of what happens to your life, you know, the losing your job, the chronic unemployment, the having to sell your home. I had to sell mine, cars, children's college funds get eaten up by these big, long legal battles that can take years and change your life. People have gotten divorced. So I really see this and the misunderstanding of this as a trauma, and the way that it disrupts your identity, shatters your worldviews, changes your brain and your cognition, your feeling of safety and security in the world, your beliefs, your faith in other people, your sense of belongingness, all of that gets disrupted. So that's right. Why I talk a lot about this from that psychosocial perspective.
So do you find that people that are involved in whistleblower cases, whether they're successful or unsuccessful, do they have, are there a significant number of them that do have issues with reemployment?
So I think so, and I think that's one of those conversations that we have often, is can you go back to the profession you had,
right,
if not the job you had? And I find a lot of folks end up not going back because they've been blacklisted from their original
right.
profession. Like, I know I remember talking to one lady who was an engineer. She ended up becoming a real estate agent, a nurse who became a private investigator. People have gone left a medical care to go into teaching, to kind of take that step back, or they've gone into private practice or have become self-employed, like Paul runs Running Name LLC after leaving the government. They have to find new ways to reinvent their lives and establish that new normal if they're going to recover and survive.
Right.
So it is hard.
Well, sure. And like the recent revelation that like the VA is running this views system that has outed anybody and everybody who's ever said mm-hmm. anything about anything. Aha! Therein lies mm-hmm. the seed of why the promotions are not, you know, forthcoming, and why the reviews on their work are not good. And
right. Yeah, I just talked to one police officer who was being retaliated against, having, discrimination, harassed at her medical center. She got a job at another medical center, had the offer in hand, and then it got rescinded after they talked to her current employer. And that happens so often.
I bet.
It's just, that your life just is constantly being sabotaged.
Yeah, that's harsh.
I guess, too, the one of the threads with folks that are whistleblowers, they have this really deep belief in right and wrong, which you would think we would all have, but we all know that's not true. They really believe that there is a bright line between right and wrong, and that wrong, just you can't just roll over for wrong. So they keep pressing it to their own detriment. God bless them for doing it, because that's the only way we ever find out half of this stuff.
Right. Yeah, and there's interesting research on propensity to be a whistleblower. What makes people value that? And, what is it, your own moral compass? Where does that come from? Where does your sense of right, wrong?
Yeah, what causes you to pull the trigger on that? I would imagine.
Right.
Jackie,
family,
we have
religion.
Run out of time, believe it or not. Can you imagine? I know. An hour burns through in, like, moments. It's just so fast. So, Jackie.
If I could just ask you to, so we're doing our Workplace Promise Institute September 7 through 9 in Pensacola Beach at the Hilton.
Okay.
If people would go to the workplacepromiseinstitute.org website, register for our conference.
If you send that to me, I will post it on the page for today.
I will, absolutely.
Send it to me, and it'll be right there for folks.
Thanks for coming on, Jackie.
Thanks, Jackie.
It's been very informative.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
All right, we're coming back. We're going to talk about water.
You'll never know if you don't go. You'll never shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.